This episode is brought to you by Merrick Pet Care. And if you've heard me talk about Grammy, you know that she means the world to me. I wanted a dog for probably 10 years, and I was living in an apartment, couldn't have dogs. When I finally moved somewhere else, I adopted her within weeks, and it was love at first scritch. She's about 2 feet away from me as I record this. She hangs out in the studio, and all I want to do is smooch her and look at her and stare at her. I also like feeding her because I see how happy it makes her. And there's nothing like watching her lick her chops after having yummy stuff like Grammy's Paw Pie or Real Texas Beef and Sweet Potato, which are two recipes she's been enjoying from Merrick. As her parent, I like that they use deboned meat and fish or poultry as the number one ingredient. I also like that they have these real ingredients and you can see them on the bag so you know what's in each one. And watching her do a little dance, especially with a Grammy's Pot Pie recipe, brings too much joy to my heart. Is there such a thing as too much joy? I'm not sure. But check out Merrick online or in your local pet store and look for their new packaging with real ingredients shown on the bag and inside it.
Hey, Fidelity. What's it cost to invest with the Fidelity app?
Start with as little as $1 with no account fees or trade commissions on U.S. stocks and ETFs.
That's music to my ears.
I can only talk.
Investing involves risk, including risk of loss. Zero account fees apply to retail brokerage accounts only. $0 commission applies to online U.S. equity trades and ETFs and retail Fidelity accounts. Sell order assessment fee not included. Some account types and securities excluded. Details at fidelity.com/commissions. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. Member NYSE, SIPC.
Hi, Ologites. Hi, Allie Ward here. It's me. So first off, I want to apologize to the many thousands of you who think that this episode is about gelato, because it's just straight up not. It's not about gelato at all. Gelotos in Greek means laughter. Gelare in Latin means to freeze or congeal. Two different things in origins, but that doesn't mean that you can't eat gelato while you're listening. I can't see you. You can gnaw on a ham. You can lick your tile grout. Listening to this, it doesn't matter to me. I'm just glad you're here. Hey! Okay, let's get creepy first, shall we? Your reviews help Ologies stay up kicking ass in the science charts, and I appreciate them so much. It's so great to look at the science charts and see Ologies up there in like the top 25. Just little old us making this podcast, guys. Also, I frequently write and research all alone, wearing no pants. And your reviews make my day. I read every single one. Each week, I like to read you one that just tickled me. More on tickling later. God, it's getting creepier and creepier every second. So I get others drunk. Okay. Says, thank you, Allie Ward, for showing the world that these usually academic nerds are fun, funny, interesting, besides smart. This show makes me wish I was an ologist so that Allie would ask me dumb questions. Hey, Allie, if you ever need to chat with a distiller, I will happily meet you in the lobby of an airport hotel. Actually, I think that there are some ologies related to distillery, so holler. So rate and review, I see all of your names, and I think, hey, thanks, name. So spread the word, you can tell a friend or two about the show, you can become a patron on Patreon, you can hit up ologiesmerch.com if you ever want to wear a logical love on your human body. So, on to the episode. Now, gelatology was a huge factor in my developing an obsession with ologies. I remember seeing it on this big list of, like, various different fields of study. It was wedged between, like, gastrology, which is the stomach, and I think gemology, which was episode 5. Go listen, y'all. But I saw the study of laughter, and I was like, who does that? Who are these people? What are their lives? Who are they? So I started researching and reaching out for people to interview. And last year, I started looking. And this ologist was at the top of my list. And I got in touch with the university. I explained that this was a podcast. It didn't exist yet, but it would. And I promised I'm not a terrorist or anything. And could I come and meet him? And after a year of email tag, a year, you guys, a year, I was in my car on my way to Loma Linda, California, which is a dusty academic town in the Inland Empire. And I was ushered to a basement lab for an interview. Now, shockingly and hilariously, this gelatologist may be one of the most serious subjects I've ever sat down with, which I love. I know this is an episode about humor, but it gets intense and kind of dark, but also inspiring. This is like not a party clown in a lab coat. He is not the Michael Scott equivalent of your family physician. This ologist is all business. In his words, he says he's the guy who's serious about laughter, and he is. It's wonderful. In the last few episodes of Ologies, we heard from a herpetologist who was telling me all about snake butts and an ichthyologist who was musing about fish getting it on, and they were both hilarious. And then this episode about laughter is one of the more factual ones, which is great. This chat was surprising in a lot of ways. He's an immunologist, a psychologist, and because his life's work is about how laughter affects the endocrine and immune system, he is a gelotologist. Now, in this episode, you'll learn why things are funnier in a packed theater, how a joke works broadly, why stress is maybe literally killing you, no big deal, and some interesting science behind roast jokes. So, in the doc's words, make time to get off your work merry-go-round for a bit and gorge on some gelotology with Dr. Lee Burke. I'll get some levels on you.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
How long have you been at this university?
I started in 1971.
What? Here?
Yes.
Wow.
1971.
47 years, you guys. 47 years. He started in laboratory medicine and immunology. He was working on transplants for infants. And he holds degrees in psychology, sociology, clinical laboratory science, a master's, and a PhD in clinical preventative care. So the things you can do to stop from getting sick in the first place, other than just washing your hands obsessively.
But my to be involved in psychoneuroimmunology, you have to be very eclectic.
So how many degrees do you have?
1, 2, 3.
I'll give you a minute.
5.
5 degrees.
Yep.
So the 5 degrees.
I started in psychology. I was going to go into clinical psych, and I decided, nah, it doesn't have all the answers because there's more to wellness or staying well, which was my passion, than just the psychological theoretical component. So mm-hmm. that's why I decided to step into the heavier sciences, if you please.
And now in 1971, I imagine that science didn't necessarily look at the mind and the body as super connected, or did they?
No, there was no real appreciation for mind-body connection in late 60s or early 70s. And when it came to light, the medical community didn't know what to do with this bizarre thing of a connection between mind and body. You have to remember the historical context of the separation had to do with 450 years or so ago with Descartes, and that there was a split when there was interest of integrating mind and spirit into medicine. There was great chastisement that don't you ever attempt to do that.
So who was Descartes? I'm sorry. I'm glad you asked me to ask Google because I could not remember. I had no idea. So French-born and Dutch-lived mathematician and philosopher. He wrote about something called dualism, which is the mind and body being separate, made of separate types of matter. You know, the mental can exist outside of the body, but the body cannot think. So this philosophy kind of jives with a lot of religions that claim that immortal souls occupy this independent realm of existence, distinct from the rest of the physical world. Nowadays, we're like, not so much. But this whole situation gloriously has a Wikipedia page called The Mind-Body Problem, which sounds very dramatic and or like it would have something to do with the mind wanting to eat peanut butter pancakes, but the body is like, could you not?
So the separation of dualism took place back then. We had medicine dealing just with the somatic or the body, and at that time the all-powerful entity was the church, which dealt with the mind and the spirit. So medicine was told to keep its hands off and stay with the body, and the mind and the spirit would stay with whatever they meant by mind at that time, would stay with the venue of the church. And not until probably the mid-1900s did we start to reintroduce the fact that there was a component that medicine wasn't dealing with, and that was what do we do with the mind? Because the patient that got sick and had mental illness, as most of us remember, was thrown in the room and the door was locked, and we called them a insane asylum.
Mm-hmm.
And we hadn't, it was not part of the venue of medicine of knowing what to do with patients, either in helping to keep them well or in trying to treat them relative to the aspect of the mind.
How did you get interested in studying humor and its effects on the brain? Because there's not many people out there doing that, I feel like.
Yeah, great question. How did I get started with looking at humor? I was always intrigued with the ancient wisdom of, ancient biblical wisdom, actually, of a merry heart does good like a medicine in the Old Testament of the Bible.
So when Dr. Burke said merry heart, I thought he was talking about either Merry Heart from Entertainment Tonight or like Biblical Mary. I was all confused. So I looked it up and it's Mary as in cheerful, which makes way more sense. The whole quote is, "A merry heart does good like medicine, but a broken spirit dries the bones." Ugh. Honestly, I'm now realizing that for centuries when old-timey people needed a pick-me-up, like, you know, all of your seven children just perished of diphtheria or whatever, you'd crack open the Bible instead of looking on Instagram for those lifestyle accounts that sometimes post inspirational quotes by Beyonce. So, whatever gets you pumped, man.
The statement of a merry heart does good like a medicine, but a broken spirit will dry the bone. Nothing could be more modern in interpretation of the field of psychoneuroimmunology than that statement. But I was intrigued with the positive aspect, knowing that there was this communication between brain, neuroendocrine hormones, and the immune system, what was going on relative to positive behaviors of keeping one well, of staying away from disease. So I got really interested from those perspectives.
What is a laugh? What is happening in the brain and the body?
A laugh is the physical expression of something that triggers the brain to say that this is really funny enough to provide some sort of overt expulsion of air.
I laughed. Why did I just laugh? Maybe because I didn't expect such a technical answer? But what happened physically to my face and my lungs? So a researcher named Robert Provine found that 15 muscles in your face contract and your respiratory system gets jacked up by your epiglottis, which is that throat flappy thing, half closing your air passage. So your air intake occurs irregularly and it makes you gasp. But not everyone who enjoys humor L's OL.
Or in some cases with some individuals, not an expulsion of air or a laugh or a sound that one hears from the other person. We found the latter out to be true when we were doing some early pilot studies, and one of our subjects happened to be a pathologist. Not targeting pathologist, but I'm just saying this was a pathologist that was somewhat passive and not overt. And we hooked him up with a needle in the arm, and we said, "Now here, watch this humor video that you like and laugh." So we took blood from him every 15 minutes through an hour's period of time to see what was happening with some of his stress hormones. And we thought we had really just blown the experiment, because all we got out of him were snickers and a little giggle, but nothing that would be considered a laugh. And we thought this was just a waste of time.
What was he watching?
He was watching a Abbott and Costello video. We asked him how he enjoyed. Was this funny or did you enjoy? Oh, he thought it was a scream, although there was no overt evidence of that. So one doesn't have to be falling on the floor laughing, if you please, as we typically will think, in fits of laughter. Yet the hormone response, that is the decrease in the detrimental stress hormones, was just as significant as one who was laughing overtly or out loud. So we learned a lot by what laughter is or isn't.
And what triggers a laugh? Is it something that is surprising? Is it something that is ironic? Like, why typically do we laugh?
It's a question I can't answer. there are a number of different theories about laughter or what is humorous that causes one to laugh.
They say most laughter isn't about humor necessarily, it's about relationships between people, which I think is really interesting. One theory is called the relief theory, and Freud said that laughter releases tension and something called psychic energy, which may be one reason why it's seen as healing or why laughter can be used as a coping mechanism when someone is upset or angry or sad. And this happens to my sister. I have never seen anyone else have this happen to so much, but in times when she's been really shocked or scared, she gets the giggles. It boggles us all. And even to her, she's like, I don't know why I'm laughing. Apparently, it's a way of releasing tension. So another theory is that humans are just biologically wired to laugh as communal relief once danger passes. This was so interesting to me. So a joke creates this inconsistency. And if we can figure out the riddle, this brain riddle, and realize that the surprise isn't dangerous, we laugh because we're relieved. So we have to get a little bit scared, and then we go, okay, no, it's fine. So in general, something is funny when we expect one thing, and then the punchline causes us to abruptly shift our understanding of the whole situation. And then we snort and hiccup and expel air or fart or whatever. Okay, but what makes us laughing our on the ground one?
The best definition that I think that I have to date would be we stumble on an incongruity of what is expected and what we stumble into. So it's that incongruity of what you are anticipating is going to be that does not occur, that causes you to trip on yourself, so to speak, mentally, and as a consequence, you laugh. Beyond that, I still don't know how we can describe it any better.
Do you laugh a lot in your daily life?
That's a good question. I probably don't overtly laugh a lot because I'm one of the indicators of who Dr. Lee Burke is that he's the guy that's serious about laughter. And essentially that's true, but I enjoy humor just incessantly. I grab it as much as I can. I will sit and watch humor on places like YouTube constantly.
Really?
Yeah, and that's done intentionally because now I'm going to step a little bit into the whole world of lifestyle medicine, where I firmly believe that one needs to get off the merry-go-round periodically because you want to break the cycle of the distress hormones, which, as we proceed through our daily life, we exacerbate or ramp up the distress response, which is detrimental both immunologically.
I got to ask, what YouTube videos?
I watch a lot of Carol Burnett show.
So there's a pair of comedic actors from the Carol Burnett show that he really loves, Tim Conway and Harvey Korman. I looked it up.
They do a dental scene, going to do an extraction on his colleague on the show, and it's probably one of the funniest videos I've ever seen.
Conway and Korman performed this legendary sketch. It involves a very bad dentist, and one of them, Korman, could not control his laughter during shooting the scene, and apparently at one point he had a little bit of an accident and he wet himself. But it's that legendary a comedy scene.
Okay. Oh, doctor, please get this tooth out of my mouth.
All right.
Now.
Well, let's see now. If we're going to pull her out, we'll have to have those pulley things. The pulleys and let's see, pinchy things and the little picky things. There. Pinchy, picky, pulley.
Dr. Burke says he'll put on videos like this in the middle of the day if he needs like a little boost. You know, for you, it might mean falling down a rabbit hole of Twitter memes or researching, a pig getting a massage from a cat, which if you have a chance to, you should look that one up.
So stressful day, you fired up?
Oh, I watch several times in the day. I'll just stop and just turn something on.
Was there a moment in your career where you realized you wanted to take a turn and study the effects of laughter on the immune system? Was there a moment where you thought, aha, I'm going to be the guy that does this?
The way that came about of deciding to take a look at laughter was more by accident than by design. I think Albert Einstein said, if we had all the answers, we wouldn't call it research. Or if we knew what we were doing, we wouldn't call it research.
So in 1988, Dr. Burke was researching exercise, and I hope it was like gnarly, leotard-clad jazzercise stuff, and the effects of that on the brain. And they were finding a correlation with laughter.
And indeed, that is the case. We were playing around with laughter because we found prior to that moderate exercise could literally enhance the production of something called beta endorphin. And we would put individuals on treadmills and put what we call IV angiocatheters in their antecubital vein. That's the vein that you have your blood drawn. We saw that indeed endorphins would increase differently in individuals that were physically fit conditioned versus those that were not. And that was sort of a historic finding at that time. But what intrigued me was that people were saying, at least one individual by the name of Norman Cousins, was saying that he would laugh and get pain-free sleep from watching his Laurel and Hardy videos or movies at that time, because this was a gentleman who had a disease called ankylosing spondylitis, this autoimmune disease.
So that's a type of arthritis that can cause wicked back pain. And Norman Cousins, he was a writer, a journalist, he was a world peace activist, and he'd get these massive bouts of pain. And he'd watch Laurel and Hardy via projector. This was like in the 70s before VCRs, which were these things that were like YouTube, but they weighed 50 pounds. Side note, Laurel and Hardy was a comedy duo from the 1930s, so that's kind of the equivalent of people now like watching Carol Burnett videos, or your grandchildren watching Tim and Eric in a space capsule, which we will definitely have in 40 years. Anyway, Norman Cousins, cool dude, in a lot of pain, watching old comedies.
He was able to sleep after laughing for about 20 minutes or 30 minutes at a time, and sleep for about 3 to 4 hours without any pain. So that was a trigger that I wonder what was happening with the stress hormones, and that's when we started pursuing the studies of looking at what stress hormones were affected, or the term that we use is modulated, as a result of watching and enjoying mirthful laughter, humor videos. And when we started that journey, somehow the word got out. We were then contacted by CBS 60 Minutes, who wanted to come and video what we were doing. And my first responses were, no, thank you, because that was a terrifying endeavor to invite CBS 60 Minutes to come in the door.
So 60 Minutes comes, and the interview goes well. And in short, people are like, what? Hey.
So as a result of that scenario, we decided that this was serious business, and we started to pursue it.
So then Norman Cousins, Laurel and Hardy watcher with the back pain, hits up Dr. Burke for a hangout. And Dr. Burke is like, yo, come to my lab. Let's chat. Norman's like, how can we get more serious about this research on laughter? Dr. Burke is like, well, research costs money, unfortunately. So, you know, bummer, dude.
And he said, how much? Well, I've never been asked the question of how much money I wanted to do research. So that caught me off guard. And I thought, well, if I ask too much, I'll sound foolish. And if I ask too little, I'll sound foolish. So I basically gave him a sum of money. And without question, the next words in his mouth were, out of his mouth were, who'd I write the check to?
Dun, dun, dun.
And that was our beginning.
Wow. So why does laughing help? Okay. Well, laughter can help lower what are called detrimental stress hormones like cortisol and adrenaline. That does a few things.
So if we release cortisol on a chronic basis, we will suppress our immune systems. So we are immune compromised, that's the word. So that's the detrimental effect of chronic stress, one of the mechanisms. So through 1989, we indeed produced a study of medical students showing that we could lower detrimental stress hormones while watching a humor video. And it was very real. And then through the 1990s, we continued the journey of presenting different aspects of the immune system that were modulated, changed, or affected. And the key finding at the end of the 1900s was that we published the culmination paper, included most all of the data in that paper. And I think the year 2001. As a consequence, one of the things that Norman Cousins was always intrigued and wanted to say was the fact that laughter could benefit the immune system by increasing natural killer cell activity. Now, natural killer cells are immune cells that affect the immune system in that they go after virally infected cells and they go after specific cancer cells. Mm. Very, very real. Actually, we can prognostically in women who have breast cancer, there's a type of, in laboratory medicine, a type of testing for natural killer cell activity. And it showed that it was very effective in increasing natural killer cells to kill the cancer cells. Not that it's panaceic, but it's, again, part of the totality of lifestyle medicine and choices that we make in whether we want to be happy or not happy makes a difference.
Is that a choice, do you think? In your research, how much have you discovered yourself that happiness is a choice or behaviors that increase happiness, rather, are an important choice to make?
I cannot. Happiness, to be happy, one has to pursue happiness. Sounds strange and sounds maybe selfish, but it's not. Can I become physically fit by sitting in this chair wishing to become physically fit?
Probably not. I'm no doctor.
Okay. No, you really can't. So there is a criteria of certain behavior that you have to do. I have to get up off the chair and I have to move and I have to exercise to become physically fit. I have so much aerobic exercise, so much anaerobic exercise to become physically fit or cardiovascularly fit. Well, the same thing is, I think, very true relative to being happy. One has to pursue those things in life within, obviously, rationale and reason that makes them happy. One of the things that we're finding out that makes us happy is when we make others happy. So there is a whole science of happiness. Berkeley has an incredible program called The Greater Good.
And oh, yes, I covered them on another episode.
For more on this, you can listen to the episode titled Gratefulology is Not a Real Word, in which a very grumpy Allie Ward tries to science herself into a better mood.
What is that? What do you need in your brain to be happy? Do you need certain kind of beta waves, gamma waves?
It's a change or modulation in the type of brain frequency. It would be somewhat similar to what one wishes to attain when one reaches a true state of meditation. Mindfulness meditation and long-term meditation are now well recognized to be associated with a frequency that heretofore was not recognized as even existing, and that's called the gamma frequency. And the gamma frequency is a frequency that ranges in the range of 25 to 30 to 40 hertz. It's like a radio dial.
Let's talk brainwaves real quick. This is crazy and cool. If you're into brains, which I think we all are, we have them. Isn't it weird that right now your brain is thinking about your brain? And my brain is thinking about your brain, thinking about your brain. And now your brain is thinking about my brain, thinking about your brain, thinking about your brain. Okay, so brainwaves are essentially these synchronized electrical pulses
They're from these masses of neurons that are all chatting with each other. And these waves come in different frequencies, depending on your level of chill. Gonna run through them super quick. Delta is a deep sleep wave. It's like deep, dreamless sleep. Transcendental meditators get into delta waves. Awareness is pretty detached. Theta waves, light meditation, sleeping waves. These are present during light sleep, including REM sleep, which is also known as Dreamtown. Alpha waves is a deep relaxation wave. So usually your eyes are closed when you're daydreaming or doing like casual light meditation. Beta waves are like your everyday awake consciousness. That's when you're alert, you're using logic, you're using your brain, you need these to function. But they can also cause a lot of stress and anxiety. Gamma is somewhat newly discovered, and it's the fastest frequency. Scientists think gamma waves are associated with these like bursts of insight.
Well, the benefit of the gamma frequency is that it is a frequency that in neuroscience we now associate with what we call neural synchronization. Neural meaning nerves synchronizing or talking to each other. Well, that's a real effective brain if the brain is talking to itself. And indeed, that is the case with gamma frequency. The other intriguing aspects of gamma frequency as a result of the synchronization is that it's a frequency associated with the highest level for cognitive processing, for thinking, mm-hmm. for being functional. Well, associated with complete opposite of a depressed state. But the reality of gamma frequency being extremely beneficial. So we see the antithesis of depression relative to enhancing gamma frequency. Now, there are other modalities that enhance gamma frequency. It's not just laughter. It is enhanced, as we have studied and our research shows, it's enhanced with high antioxidant food consumption. That is, foods that are extremely high in antioxidants, and I'm talking in the range of maybe 53, 56,000 micromoles per 100 grams.
Wait, what?
That may not mean much for your listeners, mm-hmm. but the reality is that it's in the range of the top foods or spices that exist in the world that, as we know today. So apparently the antioxidants are doing something in brain that causes the induction of the gamma frequency. And
another substance, super high in antioxidants? 70% cacao or greater chocolate. This can elicit the induction of gamma frequency in the brain. So eat it, whatever. You're good. Doctor's orders.
We also have seen it with a high antioxidant concentration of various nuts. Walnuts, pecans, pistachios. So this is essentially brand new research.
This bodes well for the turtle industry, chocolate nut turtles. So, mirthful laughter, nuts, chocolate, exercise, all good things for your brain and your immune system. So, hop on a treadmill, eat a turtle, not a real turtle, a chocolate turtle, and watch comedians wet themselves.
So, we are now starting to call all of these kinds of lifestyle behaviors a term called eustress metaphors. Eustress, E-U, for the two letters, E-U come from the Greek, which mean good. Mm-hmm. Stress, good stress, eustress. It's not a word that I coined. It's a word coined by Dr. Hans Selye, who's the father of the stress adaptation syndrome and discovered the detrimental effects of stress. But before he died, he realized that all stress was not bad, that there was something called good stress, and he termed it eustress.
Dr. Hans Selye, by the way, was a badass. He was a Hungarian who spoke 8 languages. He would wake up at 5 a.m. every morning to swim, and then he'd ride his bike 6 miles to work, and he kind of discovered stress. He would see patients who just looked like garbage, and a lot of them were under a lot of strain. So, in fact, when he coined the word, he's like, let's call it stress. He did, English wasn't his first language, and he said he regrets using stress and wishes he would have called it strain, because that's more accurate. But now we say stress in, like, all the languages, pretty much. Oh, except in Chinese, where I found out it's called crisis, and it's depicted by 2 characters put together, one for danger and one for opportunity, which is so painfully accurate. Have you ever heard the theory or the just... the general assumption that a lot of comedians are depressed people? What do you think about that? Is that self-medication then?
A lot of them lived very long lives.
Dr. Burke pointed out that George Burns lived to be pretty old. He died at the age of 100. And I looked up George Burns plus depression, but all the articles capitalized the D in depression. And then I realized they meant, as in the Great Depression, because George Burns was born in the 1800s, y'all, before comedians free-based crack cocaine and set themselves on fire with high-proof rum. And I'm looking at you, Richard Pryor. I did a little more digging, and this study was published in a cardiac journal in 2016, and it examined the lives of almost 500 people, including 200 stand-up comedians, around 100 comedy actors, around 200 dramatic actors. So the average age of death for stand-up comedians was shorter, at around 67 years. The dramatic actors lived 3 or 4 years longer. So they think that stand-up comedians, well, first off, they're more likely to die from car accidents, from suicide, and from drug misadventures. Also, stand-ups tend to pull late nights, you know, in venues. They do a lot of travel. But also, the majority of comedians tend to have a few personality traits in common. They have higher than average to very well above average intelligence. And some studies have linked high intelligence to depression. You win some, you lose some. But humor can also decrease the social distance between people. And Patton Oswalt once said in a CNN documentary that a lot of comedians are people that are very introverted, very shy, very sensitive to humiliation. So the only way to combat that is to go to the one place where you're stripped bare, in his words. And there's a British comedy researcher, Gordon Claridge, who said that comedy may partly be a form of self-medication. So it's important to note, too, that those who make comedy may not always be the same people who benefit from it. You know, watching a stand-up special at home is decidedly less stressful on your body and your mind than, like, working on new material for 2 years or selling a stand-up special, recording it in front of 1,000 people, and then hoping it rates well so you get another one. Again, I'm not a doctor, but watching comedy, much less stressful than making it. So, comedians, sometimes they get a little wild.
But much like most of us who work for a living, get stressed from our work and have consequences as a result of the work. And by the way, that's the reason you get off the merry-go-round periodically and reset your set point with the use of laughter or music that moves your soul or some form of appropriate meditation. Just watch the crystals don't hit your head.
What about laughing yoga? Does that count as mirthful laughter? Because mirthful laughter is organic laughter, right? Not psychotic laughter.
There's a controversy of whether laughter yoga is the same as intrinsic-oriented. But laughter yoga is, I don't believe, is the same thing as an intrinsic experience.
Are you ready for some questions from listeners?
Sure.
Yeah, there's so many, but I'm going to go through the best ones quickly. We won't ask all of them. There's no way I can ask you all of them. But before we take questions from you, our beloved listeners, we're going to take a quick break for sponsors of the show. Sponsors? Why sponsors? You know what they do? They help us give money to different charities every week. So if you want to know where Ologies gives our money, you can go to alleyward.com and look for the tab Ologies Gives Back. There's like 150 different charities that we've given to already, with more every single week. So if you need a place to go donate a little bit of money, but you're not sure where to go, those are all picked by ologists who work in those fields. And this ad break allows us to give a ton of money to them. So thanks for listening, and thanks, sponsors.
What do you get for the mom who birthed you into the world? I know, a candle. Are you like, no, that's not quite enough. How about memories that she'll love looking at every day? Aura frames? I love them. So they're a digital photo frame. They were named the best digital photo frame by Wirecutter and by me. And Aura frames are Wi-Fi connected. You can add unlimited photos and videos, and you can invite as many people as you want to the frame. There are absolutely no hidden fees. There's no subscriptions. You can also react with cute emojis if you'd like, and you can show you love a photo. You can send congratulations or more. It's so wonderful that A, it's not a candle, and also it's not sharing your photos on social media to look at. It's just there. You can share it with the people who you love. I have mentioned this so many times, but my parents have an Aura that I got them. My dad loved that. I have gotten Aura frames for friends, for family members of friends. So I'm a really big fan of them. I love what they do. And right now, Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off, plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. So that's AuraFrames.com. Use the code Ologies at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply. I love these things.
Warmer, sunnier days are calling. Do you know what that means? It means I won't be making soup over a hot stove. I will be making Factor, because they are fresh, never frozen meals that are dietitian approved. They're ready to eat in just 2 minutes. And watch out, they're delicious. I was like, are they really as good as people say? I have some neighbors. One of them's a nurse. One of them is a firefighter. And yes, they're both as attractive as they sound. They're like, yeah, we love Factor meals. And I was like, I bet you do. You're gorgeous. Boom. Tried them. I was like, these are delicious. They're also good for days when I'm lazy. They have 35 different meals. You'll always have new flavors to explore. I have never had a Factor meal that I've been like, nah. They've all been so good. Restaurant quality meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon and shrimp and blackened salmon. Also, way more healthy and less expensive than takeout or ordering in. So there you go. Trust my hot neighbors. Head to factormeals.com/ologies50 and use the code ologies50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month. That's code ologies50 at factormeals.com/ologies50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month while your subscription is active. Bon appetit. You're welcome. Sometimes it takes a different approach to help you unlock your true potential. Capella University's game-changing FlexPath format helps you learn at your own pace and fit earning a degree into your life. From before you enroll to after you graduate, you'll be supported by people who are invested in your success, so you can pursue your goals knowing that help is available if you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu. I know I usually save my secrets for the end of the episode, but I'm going to tell you my secret favorite candy. It's Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. It's really Reese's anything, but Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the thing that I'm like, have I had a bad day? I get these. Have I had a good day? I get these. Chocolate, salty peanut butter, the textures. I love everything about them. Also that there's two. So I'm like, oh, I get this one for later, which is 1 second later. Anyway, Reese's Peanut Butter Cups, I love you. That's all. If you're me, you can shop Reese's Peanut Butter Cups now at a store near you. Found wherever candy is sold. And I am. Okay. Your questions.
Okay. So these first questions come from my Patreon subscribers. So Priscilla wants to know, does a smile have the same effect on the body as a laugh?
There is some evidence that a smile elicits a similar response because for some individuals, a smile is equivalent to a laugh because they're not as overt as others are. There is a benefit, just a little additive here. There is a benefit of seeing somebody smile because we have in brain what we call mirror neurons. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Mirror neurons is where we replicate that which we see. And if that sounds strange, it's not so strange in the sense that as we are walking down a hallway and we see somebody laughing at the other end of the hallway as a group of people, we have no idea what the context is, yet we will start to smile in response. So a smile does, by virtue of conditioning, we're creatures of conditioning, indeed can elicit a beneficial response.
Rachel wants to know, why do some people, me, she says, cry when we laugh really hard.
I think it's just, it's just part of the package. Yeah, it just, you are just overflow. Tears will roll down the eyes. I mean, one can get into whether it's a sense of the eyes cleansing themselves. If it's funny, it's good, enjoy it. Cry, whatever.
That's a great motto. Katie wants to know, is laughing something that's developed in us biologically, or is the origin social? She says, it seems like we can't control it, but she doesn't know what the evolutionary advantage of laughter would be.
Great question.
Right? Way to go, Katie Anderson.
We are programmed to laugh. We are born to laugh. Have you ever seen a 3 to 4 month old child giggle and smile and laugh?
Yeah, they're giggle. They're meaty giggle boxes.
Where did they learn that?
Innate. So it's innate.
Sure. Yet they can't speak one word.
Mm-hmm.
So the brain is programmed to have laughter, to utilize laughter. Yet we don't do that in our society. In fact, when we go to school, I grew up in Canada, and I spent the first 18 years of my life in Canadian school, the British system, if you please. And education was serious, and teacher told me so. Don't fool around in class. And she would waggle her finger at me. Get serious. Life is serious. So we socialize ourselves by removing that reality of being programmed or innately born with the utilization of laughter. After all, laughter is a good medicine.
Mm-hmm.
We're told to get serious about life, and we do, and we pay the price for it.
Laughter isn't something that's conditioned, rather the lack of laughter is conditioned more so.
We're deconditioned to remove laughter as part of being human.
Mm-hmm.
Yet we go home in the evenings and look for the best sitcom we can,
mm-hmm.
which is a whole another discussion of the sitcoms that are on television today versus do they really represent appropriate humor?
Right. What is appropriate humor?
Humor. Well, appropriate humor is when we can laugh at ourselves without mockery. And today's humor is your mother looks like a pig.
Mm.
So we are causing a sense of detriment and derogatory meaning to the sense of humor. So I'm supposed to find humor that is demeaning and derogatory as being now the new definition of humor. The question is not just the overt observation, but what is then the neuroscience or the psychological translation of that demeaning or derogatory pursuit?
Right. Does it cause as much eustress as humor that doesn't rely on another's kind of misery or taking down a peg?
Well, is that degradation now the new norm? So the question is, if I'm laughing at somebody telling me a joke about my mother looking like a pig and they find it absolutely hilarious, that doesn't fit with my biology.
So remember, laughter follows this perceived threat found to be benign. So if an insult comic is too cutting, that sense of like, oh, never mind, everything is fine, starts to be kind of threatened. And I couldn't find a lot of research on this. I did a lot of looking, but maybe if the jokes are at another's expense, the threat isn't imminent to you. So the laughter comes from having been spared the insult comic's attention. I don't know. I myself get super uncomfy with insult comics and roasts because, like, human beings are so fragile and it just bums me out. But the late Dr. William F. Fry, who was a Stanford psychiatrist, he was kind of the founder of modern gelotology, explained that laughing when someone trips, however, happens when we know that the situation didn't ultimately harm them. So watching someone stumble like over a pigeon and drop an ice cream might be funny because the ice cream was the only thing that was really harmed, you know. But if the person died in the fall and also killed the pigeon, it would be kind of outside the play frame and not funny. So we'd empathize with the harm, and the threat could no longer be benign unless you were a dick and you didn't care or like really invested in the ice cream and that bummed you out. Thomas Pico asked, why do we laugh when we watch slapstick? Why is watching someone slip on a banana peel funny, like laughing at the Three Stooges causing each other pain? Is that funny? Should that be funny?
Well, I'm not sure that the pain is the issue of what's being funny. What is funny is the fact that we know that we have periodically slipped on something, and we find that identity. They just take it to the extreme that we can identify with.
When it's directed at the human experience or back at ourselves or a surprise factor, it has different benefits neurologically.
Sure.
Side note, my own question. In a current climate that seems high stress lately, do you feel that people are doing enough to kind of combat stress of the news cycle? Like, given that our news cycle is now 24 hours, we're constantly getting alerts on our phone and things like that. Do you think people are watching enough humor? Do you think it's a good balance these days?
No, I think I don't think we're watching enough that which counters the detriment. Do we see society improving in its interaction with each other as a result of the enhancement of the technology and the communication with the media and the news as it is today?
Right. Not so much, perhaps. Here's a theory. It seems to be a depressing time lately, so let's laugh more.
What then is our stopgap, or how do we counter that? It's at a molecular level.
And I think we take stress for granted so much. Just it's something that we deal with, it's something that happens, and it's something that very much is in the mind. But it's not in the mind when you consider immunology and autoimmunity as well is affected.
Every thought process has biotranslation. There's no thought that either we create in ourselves or comes into us that doesn't have biological translation. The question is, then what is the consequence of that translation? It's like a fork in the road. Do you want it to benefit you, or is it going to be detrimental? So it depends what you're watching, listening to, and what you're doing.
I have a few more questions. These are from people in the Facebook group. This question came up probably no fewer than 6 times. Why do we laugh when someone tickles us? And why can't we tickle ourselves?
We haven't studied that yet.
No. That's the next study.
Yeah, I don't have an answer for that.
So this may not be Dr. Burke's wheelhouse, but some evolutionary biologists think that we laugh when we're tickled because there's a part of the brain called the hypothalamus, and that tells us to laugh when we experience a light touch. It's the same part of us that says, hey, a painful sensation is coming. So when someone goes for like a tickle zone, like your pits or your feet or your throat, they could be killing you with their hands. And laughing could have evolved as a defense mechanism to show that we're submissive to an aggressor and make the tension go away. You laugh at people's jokes and maybe they'll like you. They won't get peeved. And you perhaps giggle at tickles. Maybe your airways won't get crushed by someone. So thanks, human brain. Now, do other species of animals laugh? McKenna asked that.
Well, they claim certainly the chimpanzees have a form of laughter. I even think there is one investigator who studies from the neuroscience standpoint that rats have a form of laughter, and they can monitor the frequency and he's calling that laughter.
Okay, go get your eyes on this National Geographic video about rat tickling.
So here's the sound a rat makes if you tickle its back.
The video goes on to note that the rats freaking love it. They seek out this gloved hand of the researcher for more tickling. They chase the hand around. It's kind of like a little tiny sewer dog with a long, snaky tail.
If you've ever seen a dog that's panting somewhat and the tail's wagging, they claim that to be some form of laughter.
That would make sense given our social relationship mm-hmm. with them as a yeah. as a means of bonding or communicating.
Yeah, yeah. But to answer that question more specifically, one would have to look at what is brain doing.
Mm.
Okay. And is it similar in response in their brain? I think most animals have some sense of capability of laughter, if you please, or want to call it laughter, being associated with happiness or joyfulness.
I have one last question, but it's a two-parter. What is the hardest thing about your job or your least favorite thing about your job? It can be anything from like the vending machines in the cafeteria to research funding to having to iron shirts to the mysteries of gamma waves. I always am curious about what the most challenging thing is.
Of the job or mm-hmm. of life?
Either. I would say the most challenging thing about being a psychoneuroimmunologist slash gelatologist.
Not having a 25th hour.
Not enough time. What would you do in that 1 hour?
Albert Einstein said this real well on his deathbed. He said, "I've only started."
So that you can't do it all.
Yeah.
That's the hardest thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I get asked by students, not asked the students, "Dr. Burke, you know so much, you know." And it's the most humbling statement in the sense my response is, no, I really don't. I thought I knew a lot yesterday, but I know less today.
What is your favorite thing about what you do?
Everything.
Everything?
Yeah. I'm pretty lucky. I'm lucky to be doing what I'm doing. I'm lucky to be, anybody in your audience, don't ever think because you're so diverse that it doesn't pay off. It certainly does, because you get to see and think of different perspectives that you would never, ever have the opportunity to do so. And I started, you know, with this degree in psychology and sociology and on, it was so diverse. It all came together when I stumbled into psychoneuroimmunology and realized how everything was intertwined,
mm-hmm.
interwoven, interrelated, and the reality of the consequence of any one thought either going for better benefit or detriment is very real, and that's by choice.
You are just a new hero of mine. So to learn more about Dr. Burke and his work, the work of Burke, go to his website at dr-lee-burke.com. And I post links and photos at allieward.com/ologies for all the episodes. You can follow Ologies on Instagram or Twitter. It's just @ologies. You can join all the lovely ologites at the Ologies Podcast Facebook group. Great group of people, and they always have really interesting links and insights into the episodes. You can follow me at Allie Ward, Allie with one L, on Twitter or Instagram, or become a patron at patreon.com/ologies. I tell you what topics are coming up next. You get kind of some sneak information there, and then your questions get asked to the ologists. So you can join for as little as 25 cents an episode. Thank you to Stephen Ray Morris for all the edits on this episode, and to Shannon Feltis and Bonnie Dutch for their amazing work they do at ologiesmerch.com. I have tons of stuff up there that they've helped design and help me manage. So head to that site. You can browse the goods. Also, if you're near Portland on February 22nd and you want to meet the thanatologist from a few episodes back, Cole Imperi, she's so great. The link for a special dinner with her in Portland on the 22nd of February is in the show notes, so you can click on that. Nick Thorburn did the music for Ologies, and if you like it, you should check out his band Island or his solo work, Nick Diamond. He also did the Serial theme music. Isn't that crazy? He's great. And per usual, I always tell a secret at the end of the episode, and I thought it would be interesting to hear what the hardest you guys have ever laughed. So I don't know, tag it gelatology and let me know. But I want to hear what the hardest you guys have ever laughed is. I'll tell you mine. I think the hardest I've ever laughed was watching this video posted to YouTube by a user called Food Plot. It's about a dog named Denver who eats cat treats. I just did a whole thing where I thought I'd watch it while recording, but it was too much shrill cackling, so I just deleted it. But it's anyway, it's really good. Okay. Ask smart people dumb questions. You know the drill. Bye-bye.
Pachydermatology. Homeology. Cryptozoology. Litology. Nanotechnology. Meteorology.
For 25 years, Mike's has been making lemonade the hard way. Mike's Hard Lemonade. Hard days deserve a hard lemonade. Mike's is hard. So is prison. Don't drive drunk. Premium all beverage with flavors. All registered trademarks used under license by Mike's Hard Lemonade Company, Chicago, Illinois.
Hey guys, Sean Hayes here. Jason Bateman, Will Arnett, and I had a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to sit down with not one, not two, but three presidents of the United States on our recent episode of Smartless. That's because President Biden, a returning guest, brought two of his favorite pals, former Presidents Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, all joined us for unforgettable conversation. It's a historic episode of Smartless as we pry into the minds of these remarkable leaders. We'll cover everything from their time in office, America's responsibilities in the world, and their personal passions in an episode full of some candid stories, insightful perspectives, and a few surprises along the way. Whether you're a political junkie or just curious about the inner workings of the Oval Office, this episode is a must listen. Don't miss out on this incredible opportunity to hear from three of the most influential figures in recent American history. Follow Smartless on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also listen to Smartless ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.